Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here, and we're taking a look at your car and its maintenance today with our guest, Jim Ward, Service Director at Smart Motors, over 10 years of master certification. And Jim, I was always calling you a service manager. Now you're promoted. You're the top guy.
Yep, my boss retired, and I applied for, and it's an exciting change.
Well, it's great to have you back, and really look forward to your visit every time you come by. Always something to talk about, and let me give the numbers to call. If you'd like to join in with a question for Jim, the number is 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page or on Twitter. Love to hear from you. Tell you what, we get potholes all the time here in Wisconsin, and they always seem to come in spring. And I guess, what is it, heaving or what's going on?
Well, you get normal cracks in the road just from normal wear and tear. Water seeps in, it freezes, it expands, it creates a gap. When it melts, there's some compression. It's kind of, you can imagine, when you get sinkholes, a pothole really is just a miniature sinkhole. The supporting structure and stuff underneath the pavement, as the pavement cracks, gets washed away between the freezing and thawing cycle, and that section drops. As it drops, it starts to break apart. People drive over it, and chunks start coming out of it because they're loose, and it just gradually gets deeper to the point where, you know, it might be a little bump one day, and a couple days later, with the heaving, we get frost heaving on top of it. Pieces get pushed out, and it can become a pretty good size hole pretty quickly. And then, of course, we also have pavement buckling, where that's a little bit more dramatic, a little bit more along the lines of like a mini earthquake, where because of the uneven freezing and because there's uneven wear in the road and uneven amounts of that kind of wear, one part can buckle up over another one and create a much bigger hole. And, you know, it can just cause you to come close to spilling your coffee, or it can cause some serious accidents. I mean, just damage to an individual car, or people panicking and running into one another. This week we've had some real tragic results in traffic. And I don't know if that had anything to do with road buckling, but about a month ago, we did have some roads buckling, and that led to a multi-car accident. So it's a reality of Wisconsin roads and the spring and winter thaw and freeze cycles.
And, you know, I just, Brennan, one of our guys that works in my office, showed me a photo of his tire that he said blew up. And I said, well, no, it's not a blow up. When I looked at the tire, I said the seal broke on the tire, and that's probably from a pothole or something.
Exactly. And the thing often about potholes is that you may hit a pothole hard enough that it almost separates the tire from the rim. The next big bump could do it. It may not necessarily happen the first bump that you hit. You can also tear the inner wall of a tire can get torn a little bit from a big bump like that. The result, if you would look at it afterwards, would be like a bulge on the outside of the tire. But the next bump might very well cause a blowout of a tire or a separation. So it's, you know, the thing is, almost everyone has probably hit a pothole and had no actual consequence. And it's certainly possible. In fact, most of the time, nothing really terrible happens. It's if it's hard enough that it really jars it, I mean, you do want to take a look at some things. Pay attention to how your car handles. Is the steering wheel still straight, or is the steering wheel cocked now? If the steering wheel's not straight anymore, even just a little bit, a degree or so, you probably should have your alignment checked. But looking at wheels for bending, tires for bulges, and just generally paying attention to, does the car handle the same after the bump as it did before? Does the steering drift to one side or the other? Do you have a shake? Do you have any kind of instability when you go over bumps and dips compared to previously? And some things to pay attention to, because it's going to happen to you.
Does it make a difference, let's say, if you're in an SUV or a truck, are you going to be less problematic or more than if you were in a small car, let's say?
It does make a little bit of a difference. I mean, one of the things that happens besides the tire and wheel contacting, typically the tire and wheel go into a hole, into a pothole. The damage tends to occur when they come up the other side. A spinning wheel that's turning is less likely to be damaged than if you've jammed on the brakes and that wheel has stopped. Although, obviously, if if you're having to avoid something else, somebody else that just went through it that's stopping, you may still have to brake. But if you can avoid it, it's best not to brake while you're going through a pothole. But what happens, the car dips down. And on a smaller car, especially a lot of cars that are fuel-efficient cars are lower to the road, they're as that part of the suspension drops down, the weight of the car shifts to that wheel, and it causes even more compression of the suspension, and you can bottom out. You can bottom out the actual undercarriage of the car, which might do nothing but scrape a little bit. It might loosen a plastic splash shield, which wouldn't really be a big deal, or it can do some serious damage. It can break exhaust parts off. It can do all kinds of things. So a truck or an SUV tending to be a taller vehicle and having a greater ground clearance because they generally have bigger tires and wheels and have suspensions that bring them up off the ground to intentionally create greater ground clearance are less likely to bottom out like that in a pothole, but their tires and wheels are just as vulnerable as a car. Yeah.
Well, this and Dan in Eau Claire, we'll get to you in just a second. You can join in too, by the way, 800-642-1234. But this was tire day in our office, and Mark, our IT guy, has a 2012 Toyota Corolla, loses pressure in just one tire, the left rear, in cold weather. He has a heated garage, but when he parks it outside, you know, he comes back, and on a cold day, it's down to 26 pounds. And he says it always goes to 26.
Most tires will lose some air when the temperature changes and we get cold. I mean, we'll see at our service drive, we'll air up tires at no charge. So people just stop in. If that tire light comes on, we say, just come on in and we'll air them up for you. And it's very predictable. If you get a sudden drop in temperature overnight, there's going to be a parade of tire lights the next day that you wouldn't see otherwise. But if it's just one tire on the car, that's losing more than the others, then that's not just going to be that normal loss from the cold weather. There's a leak there somewhere, and it could be around the rim where the tire seals on the bead. That area gets corroded and can become porous-like. It could be the valve stem where you put the air in, and it could be that the tire has a puncture. And generally, that kind of leak is initially inspected just with soapy water. Spray it on there, and where the leak is will tend to bubble. They'll spray the water on the valve where you fill it. They'll spray the water around the tire, the wheel bead. Look for bubbles coming out there. They'll spray the soapy water around the face of the tire, the tread, looking for, you know, it may have been punctured in the nail or screw or whatever may have come out. In fact, often they don't leak much while it's still in there, but if while driving you hit other bumps and stuff, it gets taken out, then the leak starts at a greater pace if it wasn't leaking prior to that. And so spraying it, you'll see bubbles at that spot. Some leaks are stubborn. They won't show up that way, and sometimes we have to take them off and actually have what we call dunk takes. You put it underwater and watch for the bubbles to come up, because that's even, you know, it's a little more work to take the tire off, so we usually look with the tire on the car with the soap first. But
sure.
But those are the kind of things that need to be done. They'll get to the bottom of that and either have to reseal the tire on the rim or repair a puncture or, yeah.
Yeah. Jim Ward, director of service director at Smart Motors, our guest today. Dan in Eau Claire, thank you for waiting. What's on your mind?
Yeah, I got a 2004 Ford Explorer, and it doesn't have a dipstick to check the transmission fluid. How often should that be changed?
I'm not familiar enough with Ford's 04 Explorer change interval, but you should have a maintenance guide. You've got an owner's manual and a maintenance guide, and the manufacturer's recommendations are what you stick with. Typically, sealed transmissions that don't have a dipstick tend to use world spec synthetic fluid that either has no interval to change or may have an interval if and only if you tow with the vehicle because of the increased load that you put on it when you tow. Typically, if it is a transmission that is recommended to be serviced under towing situations, that's usually about every 60,000 miles. But again, I would take a look at Ford's recommendations for that year and model and for that transmission fluid. The sealed transmissions tend to go much longer if they require a service interval at all.
There you go.
Thanks,
Dan. Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Let's go to David in South Milwaukee next. Hi, David.
Well, hello there. Nice to have you back on again.
Hi, David.
I'd like to find out what one can do about a fogged-up headlight lens, how to prevent it, what to do if you got it, and what the heck causes it.
Well, when you say that, I'm thinking that you're talking about the the sun damage, the UV damage that makes the lens kind of go yellow as opposed to like moisture condensation on the inside of the lens?
That's correct. I don't know if it's yellow, but it's just all frosted up. But I don't know what causes it.
Well, it's UV. It's UV damage. The lenses are made out of a type of plastic, and that plastic is subject to UV breakdown. That outer layer of the plastic really just starts to get porous. If you have toys like kayaks that are made out of polyethylene and you leave them out in the sun, you may get in it one day and see water bubbling up through underneath you, and it's really no different on any kind of plastic, that the outer layers kind of get sunburned and they become kind of holy. They get little holes and stuff in them, and those will go deeper and deeper the longer they're exposed to the sun. There are products that do work to take that off, and in fact, I don't recommend this, but I'd read it once, and I took one of my son's older cars, and I had to try it. Repel insect repellent, which of course don't use products for things they weren't designed for, but it's strong enough to melt plastic, and so ultimately I tried spraying it on one of the lenses and wiping it off, and sure enough, it cleaned that lens up and it looked really good. There are other products that are specifically made for that, that consist of various types of abrasive that are abrasive enough to take that layer off the surface and get down to some better plastic. And ultimately, those products have improved quite a bit over the years. The earlier ones that we would try would not last very long. So in my experience, the Repel insect repellent lasted about a month and a half, 2 months. That light was fogged up again. a less expensive, apparently low-end product that you just do it yourself, that you just kind of rub on and buff off, lasted about 6 months. And there are products that basically you do with a high-speed buffer that really is a little bit more precision, takes off a little bit more predictable layer, tend to last even longer, can last up to a couple of years. But one of the problems with these things is that if you've done it once, the next time it's not as likely to be as effective as it was the first time. And, if it's bad enough, just replacing the lens assembly is not necessarily a bad idea. The lens assemblies, of course, I'm a new car dealer, I should say. I always buy new car parts from the new car dealer. But honestly, in the aftermarket, there are some incredible deals on headlight, taillight assemblies, on what you can buy them for. And you might be surprised what little expense it is to buy a replacement.
There you go. Thanks, David, for calling. Let's go to John in Presque Isle next. Hi, John.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call, you guys. I really appreciate your show.
Sure.
I've driven over 2 million miles and started as a boy working in a wrecking yard in Phoenix, Arizona back in 1970. And have been around, know enough to be dangerous a little bit. And I had a very interesting event this past week. I was underneath a truck at my service provider that was up in the air on a rack, and I was shown the drive-by-wire technology that was on this new truck, and I was alarmed. It's a technology that communicates a wire from your steering wheel, a potentiometer that gives the relative position of the steering wheel, and then sends it down by wire to a push-pull on a rack and pinion. You guys are talking about potholes and road hazards. I have a brother-in-law who hit an alligator going across Alligator Alley. And I'm sure that his steering wouldn't have survived if it was drive-by-wire. And the kinds of roads that we have in northern Wisconsin are some pretty tough roads. And it's just a polite pushback. And someone like your knowledgeable guest can get the word back up the line that, you know, sometimes these are dry holes that they design and push down. I sure hope they keep mechanical steering. You might have electronic assistance, but don't take away the connection from the steering wheel to the road.
Yeah.
Well, John, you're not going to probably like if you start researching where auto technology is going. It's going to more of that type of technology and everything. And the automotive new car development is hurtling toward autonomous driving cars and systems like that. Literally, your most cars now, the gas pedal is simply an electronic request, no throttle cable going up to the actual throttle. Brakes are similarly dual controlled. You may have a conventional hydraulic brake system, but in as much there's still an overriding electronic request. Steering the same way, electronic steering. I'll tell you that the electronic steering is perhaps more durable than, they design these and they do test them for what happens in potholes when you hit curbs, and it can have some dire consequences. One of the things that can happen with electronic steering is if you hit a curb and turn and it forces the wheel to turn really hard, the electric motor that normally gives the assist, if it's forced the opposite direction, it can suddenly become a generator and fry the computer that runs that electronic steering system.
And, oh, boy.
You know, and so all of a sudden, instead of just having some mechanical damage, you have significant steering column, the electronic control unit, the power motor that runs it are all one assembly on some cars. So those certainly have some consequences we wouldn't have seen on earlier models of cars. And like you, I can appreciate, you know, having driven a long time, cars that were more manually operated and controlled by the driver. At the same time, some of these systems can be like the little angel or guardian over your shoulder. You know, I kind of say I prefer not to have them on cars I drive, but I'd really like them to be on the cars my wife and kids drive, and maybe everybody around me. So it gets kind of unfair to say I want to have the only car that's manual. But these systems can do some very good things. That technology is also what allows a person potentially falling asleep in a car that's got lane departure technology. You could be falling asleep, and this car has got a camera up by the rearview mirror that is able to identify what the lines and the lanes in the road would be. And if you're leaving your lane, it can alert you. You have fallen asleep, it can alert you that you're leaving your lane because you didn't use a turn signal before you began to leave that lane. And it can even do subtle things like the computer can make it such that it is more difficult then to turn the steering, continuing to go into that wrong lane, and easier to turn it back where you're supposed to go. So, you know, those technologies sound scary, and they can be, and they can cause more expensive repairs to have to be done on cars. Certainly, similarly, the technology in the design of cars and the way cars break away to protect the driver means that in what would have been a minor accident with lesser damage on a car years ago is going to be quite a bit more damage to the car in the interest of protecting the occupants in the car. It's a double-edged sword. Some of the things about these technologies are very good, and some of them are terrifying.
John, thank you so much for calling. Jim Ward, our guest today, Service Director at Smart Motors of Madison. I'm Larry Mueller. Jill Nadeau, our producer here on the Ideas Network. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Jim Ward, Service Director at Smart Motors of Madison. Talking vehicle maintenance, and you can join in. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Give a call. Let's go to Jeff in La Crosse next. Jeff, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hey, good morning. Thank you. I'd like to ask about the recent Ford Motor Ranger airbag recall, and they recommend that you not drive your car. It's got months before I have my appointment. Is there a fuse I can pull, or what would your recommendation be for disconnecting maybe that airbag, or just take my chances?
Yeah,
they don't typically make it easy to disconnect airbags. I mean, they're technically not really a fuse. A person could go into the wiring and disconnect a wire and have an airbag light on, but in that circumstance, none of the airbags are going to work in the event of a collision. You know, this is a problem that a lot of industries could face when a monopoly begins to occur and one given company begins to make a given component that ends up in so many vehicles. Different manufacturers have different support programs for these kind of concerns because of the parts delay. I know with the particular line of cars that I deal with Toyotas, they had programs that weren't exactly advertised on a large scale, where you could be put into loaner cars. And some of these vehicles that we replaced inflators on, you know, those people were in a loaner vehicle for 2 months that Toyota covered before the airbag became available and we could replace it. So I would take a look and find out if there isn't a support program that you may be able to do that would really be preferable to disabling the system in the car.
Yeah, absolutely. Good luck with that, Jeff. Thank you. So he just gets back to his dealer.
Right. Yeah. Find out what Ford's policy is on that.
Let's go to Ron next in La Crosse. Hi, Ron.
Yeah, you know, I see all these car ads for cars on TV, and, you know, and they're all showing all these electronic bells and whistles that the engineers have festooned the dashboards with. I think these engineers are taking a path of least resistance. What people really need are tires with smart studs, you know, studs that could be retracted when the driving conditions don't require studded. I remember back in the early 70s, B.F. Goodrich and then the other tire makers introduced studded tires. And they worked real good, and I'm sure the insurance companies liked them. But unfortunately, they chewed up the roads, and I think a lot of states, including Wisconsin, banned the sale of them. So they pretty well, as they use a pun, fell by the roadside. But I think with all the technology, why can't they come up with sort of an electromagnetic device or something that could retract smart studs from tires when they're not eating, and then extend them, you know, have an override switch where you could, they would only be enabled if you turn on the switch and also hit the brakes.
Hmm. You know, I don't doubt the technology's out there to do it. And I also know that there aren't very many people out there that say tires aren't expensive enough already, although the technology obviously could save lives and have great potential. It's interesting. When I look at prototypes of where tires are potentially going, I see all kinds of things like that. There are pending patents for systems like that. There are pending patents for tires that are more like a round rubber ball with a ring around it that potentially would allow you to have different driving surfaces depending on the conditions, and also to allow that tire to potentially parallel a car sideways. So, I mean, there certainly are some interesting technologies that are out there. They're not cheap, you know, they're at least at this point in time. And of course, if something does get adopted, it goes to mass production, competition begins, and costs can come down. So, you know, certainly there are things like that that are being researched. From what I see, I don't see anything like that on the market probably for 5 to 10 years.
No, there we go. Thanks, Ron. Appreciate it. Let's go to Mike in Mercer next. Hi, Mike. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I've got a 2014 Subaru Outback, and there's a strange noise coming from the left rear wheel well that I think might be the ABS brake. When the car is parked in the garage, the key is not even in the ignition, and I hear this noise like a little motor or a little pump or a little clicking noise coming from the left rear wheel. And it doesn't happen all, it just happens very occasionally. But I asked a service technician recently and he drew a blank. Have you ever heard of the ABS brakes or something?
I've heard the what you're describing, and I'm going to bet this is probably you pull the car in the garage, and this is probably somewhere in the range of 4 to 6 hours after you parked it. You may happen to go back out in the garage and hear that little humming noise, and that humming noise may go on for maybe a couple minutes.
Yep.
Is that right? Yeah. That's your evaporative system. The evaporative control system is the system that is supposed to monitor and contain the vapor over the fuel in the tank. And those systems do a self-test about 4 to 6 hours after you park your car in the garage. It may sound like a little vacuum cleaner. It is an electronic pump running, and essentially what it's doing is that there's three sections to that evap system, back by the tank, between the tank and the intake up at the engine, and the part by up by the engine. There's valves in between, and they're supposed to be able to isolate and contain between each other, and that test goes through each one of those to make sure that they do what they're supposed to do. And if they don't, when you get back in that car and start it later, you're going to have a check engine light on, and it would have a code register saying that this evaporative system isn't doing its thing right. And the most common reason that happens is not tightening the gas cap till it clicks afterwards. Uh-huh. But yeah, lots of people have heard that self-test and have called and asked questions about that. But that's what you're hearing. That's what's going on there. And it is just inside the left rear wheel. So proximity
right
to the brake is logical, but that's not what it is.
Yeah,
logical, but wrong.
But really interesting.
I've been there many times, which is that's how knowledge is comes about.
Thanks, Mike.
Appreciate it. Yeah, thank you.
Thanks a lot for calling. That's something new. I learn something new every day, and there's just another little bit of information new to me. Sandra in Mount Pleasant, your turn. Hi, Sandra.
Hi. It seems like this year I have really had incredible ice buildup in my wheel well to where I thought it was affecting my turns and everything. And I have a 2017 Pacifica, and I thought they have a different design where there's cloth in that wheel well. And I don't know if that happens again. Now we had warm weather and it melted, but it lasted for such a long time, and I couldn't knock it out. Is there any way of mending that? I don't have a garage to keep my car warm.
What kind of car do you, did you say
it's
you
have? Pacifica.
Oh, Pacifica.
Yeah. It, you know, this has been... this is a problem every winter, and it actually can get to the point where it affects your turning radius. Your tires generally will carve away the snow and ice if you try to turn, but it can, you can actually feel it in the steering wheel if there's enough of it there. We had a cold spell back between Christmas and New Year's, and we've had a few since. That first one was, I think, like a 100-year record of 13, 14 days, at least in this area. And so ice can get harder and be more tenacious than at other times. Those pieces that are up in those wheel wells and some of the plastic trim around the wheel opening on the outside of the car are often plastic anymore because they're plastic generally is not as likely to chip and rust from the things it's going to be exposed to, rocks and stuff that get thrown up from tires. But that also makes them vulnerable in the cold. They're more brittle. And so I see this all the time, people kicking their cars and trying to kick that stuff off. And, you know, it might come off clean and nice, but you may break and damage stuff that's up in there. The best bet is to take the car through a car wash, get a hot underwash that's going to melt some of that stuff off. Generally, the cars are designed to be able to drive through snow and ice, and have some of that buildup will occur, and it may affect you a little bit. But, you know, the tire can grind away on the road for a long time without any damage to it, and it'll grind away on that ice. But it, you know, it is a concern. It can start to affect handling and some of the extreme weather that we've had, where it just doesn't get a chance to melt for weeks and just keeps building up and refreezing overnight on there. But and honestly, it really isn't a great idea to wash a car if it's much below 20 degrees, unless you're going to go drive it about 20 to 30 miles. Because if you go to a car wash and drive a mile and a half, 2 miles home, there can be consequences. You may not be able to get in it in the morning, open a door, brakes can freeze on. So there are some cautions about washing cars in that kind of weather, but that's really the best approach go ahead.
What about spraying some of that mixture of rubbing alcohol and water or something in a bottle?
And that can help too, you know, but for years I carried a can of Prestone de-icer in my car that ultimately, like if you did get, back in the days before I had a garage, if you got, you know, freezing rain and ice over the windshield, you know what a pain that is to scrape that stuff off. And the Prestone, you just spray over the whole thing and 30 seconds later it's melted and you're just wiping it off. And it would have the same effect on ice anywhere. So that's not a bad idea. I mean, if it is better than going through a car wash when it's below 20 degrees or when it's near zero and then being frozen out of your car or having other problems with things freezing up.
There you go. Thank you so much for calling. You can join in too with your car question as we talk vehicle maintenance with Jim Ward, Service Director at Smart Motors. Larry Mueller here. 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on Twitter or our Facebook page. On to Ralph in Mequon. Hi, Ralph.
Hi, Ralph. I have a 04 Toyota Sequoia, and about every 200-300 miles, I get check engine, check brakes, another code, ABS light.
Mm-hmm.
When I put the code on, it's code 128, and I think it's something about the temperature or something.
That is indicating that there's the coolant thermostat sensor is indicating that the temperature is below what the spec should be. Now, it could be that you have a thermostat that's sticking open a little bit and the engine temperature really is a little lower than it should be, but the code is just saying there's something that's not correct in that circuit. So it is either that the engine is running too cold or there's something in the wrong with the sensor or some resistance on the wire that connects the sensor to the computer that's supposed to be getting that signal, but something in that system at times is not getting the right signal or not seeing that your engine is warmed up as it should be for operation at that point. Now, those computers communicate with each other. It's not unusual at all that if you have a code like that, turn the check engine light on, that subsequently the anti-lock brake light, the vehicle skid control light, that other warning lights are going to come on, because once one computer says, I don't have all the data I need, the other computers say, well, then I can't do my part either, so I'm turning my light on as well. And so it's probably all related to this one thing. I don't think you have separate problems in those separate areas, and the fact that you're just getting the one code supports that as well. But some testing needs to be done on that circuit to find out you know, typically a computer can be connected to the car that can take the place of the sensor, take the place of the computer, and basically go through and isolate that circuit. It might even come down to taking a volt amp meter and testing continuity between the sensor and the computer. But there's something going on with that circuit that's tripping that light.
There you go. Good luck. Thanks, Ralph. And let's take some more calls. Sherwin in Elgin, Illinois, up next. Hi, Sherwin.
Hi, how are you doing? Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Yeah, I've got a Ford Ranger. It's a 2011. And for the last 2 months, I've been smelling out of the exhaust a burnt toast smell. And I tried looking into it, and I talked to two dealerships, and they said they don't understand why it should be doing this. I'm wondering if it's a catalytic converter that's bad or what.
You know, smells are a subjective thing. Yeah, I've often thought, you know, that you don't see automotive, well, you never do, but there's very few automotive guides that talk about what a given odor would mean. The one that is pretty distinct that they do talk about is the pancake syrup odor. So, you know, when you say toast, are we talking about toast with avocado, or are we talking about toast with bananas or maple syrup? But, you know, you're basically probably smelling a burnt odor. I have seen that pan out to be so many different things. You know, you can drive over a plastic bag on the road and a hot exhaust, it'll stick to it and it'll start to melt off of there, and it'll change how that smells over time depending on how until the plastic completely melted off. I mean, it starts out smelling like burnt plastic, but it changes over time. If it does smell kind of a maple-y syrup, kind of a sweet smell, that's associated with antifreeze. And so you might have a small antifreeze leak that's dripping onto the exhaust. Yeah. Catalytic converters and failures therein usually result in pretty strong sulfur odors. The catalytic converter cleans up a lot of sulfur that is in our fuel, keep it from coming out the tailpipe as a pollutant.
Yeah,
but again,
I've actually smelled the gas, the vapors coming out of the tailpipe, and it smells like if you burned toast in a toaster.
Yeah.
And it's coming right out of the exhaust, and I've sniffed under the hood. It's not under the hood. It's coming out of the exhaust. And I checked the underside, and there's nothing hanging up in there.
Nothing on it, yeah.
And I called the dealers, and they don't know. And Ford Motor Corporation, and they couldn't tell me anything.
Well, and it is, you know, because smells are subjective. I mean, you know, I'm guessing this is normal and not something that you used to smell. So the change you would think would represent that something's different and perhaps wrong. The catalyst is monitored by a system, and if it isn't working right, that usually is going to be associated with a warning light. You know, and I've seen, you know, on the more bizarre side of things, we had a car that I've heard of that had bad odors and eventually didn't want to run right and had a muffler full of dog food that resulted. That was a result of mice carrying it up in there because they thought that was going to be a good home and the dog food was a good food source. So I don't, you know, there's a wide range of things that could be going on here, but it doesn't sound like you're having any performance issues, any warning lights on, or anything else there. At this point, it really is going to come down to continue to monitor. I mean, there are shops that one of the ways we used to analyze how an engine ran before the engines had their own system to do this was a gas analyzer that you put on there and could tell you. And we had one of those. It was the size of a refrigerator that you pushed over to the car and put 100 connectors on the car. And it could tell you what your computer is kind of monitoring all the time right now. You know, if somebody still had one of those old machines that we don't, you could get a more raw analysis of what is in there, but I can tell you that it's probably not something that's harming the car because you don't have that warning light on, and you would if it were something that was malfunctioning in that catalyst or in the way that the engine's combustion was taking place.
Should I change gasoline stations then? Because I go to the same station all the time.
Logical thing to experiment with. You know, if you change gasoline stations and the odor changes, then you know, you're onto something there, but you know,
it's a very strong odor. I mean, it's like, you know, I back it in the garage, and the garage smells like burnt toast.
Yeah, and besides talking to the dealer and calling the manufacturer, have you had the car somewhere for them to actually inspect it, put it up in the air, check fluids, make sure?
No, I have not.
That's going to be the next logical thing. So, I mean, check all the fluids, make sure nothing is leaking, nothing's dripping on the exhaust up front, even though it may smell like it's coming out the tailpipe. It could be something getting on the outside of the exhaust. It's hot. Anything that gets on it is going to produce an odor.
Yeah, there we go. So give that a shot, and thanks so much for calling, Sherwin. And let's go back to the phones and to Gary in Merrill. Hi, Gary.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Okay, I have a 2013 Avalon Limited Avalon. And I've had three Avalons previous to this. And I've just really noticed on this one a major difference on kind of like the ride of the suspension. I drive a lot of miles, and it's like driving a go-kart compared to the other three that I've had. And I was just wondering, was there a change in the suspension or anything? I know that this has low-profile tires, and the other one didn't, and this does have 18-inch tires.
Sure.
So yeah. What?
Well, that's the greatest difference. The suspensions have changed on Avalons. If you've had three prior to this, you've had a range probably from 01, 02, 03, somewhere in there on up through a few different ones. And they've had changes, they've had upgrades, but the suspension is still far more similar, like the very first Avalon, your 13, than different. The low profile tires are key here. Much of what you feel for your ride suspension or ride quality, excuse me, actually comes from the tires, about half of it. Low profile tires look really cool.
Yeah.
They don't necessarily give you the best ride. There isn't as much tire there to absorb. So tires are a big factor. And of course, you know, an easy way to tell would, you know, I wouldn't necessarily buy a different set of tires, but, you know, one of the things we do in our shop would be to take a used car and take tires that weren't low profile, put them on and drive and see what we feel for a difference. You know, the low impact, low cost, quick way to do it. But I do think that's a significant difference. Low profile tires, as neat as they look, do give you a compromised ride. They do give you a compromised tire and wheel in terms of pothole survivability. You know, they're more vulnerable to damage in those situations. So that is your most likely culprit.
Well, they've told me that I cannot get any different tires on this car.
Not with the same wheels, probably, but if...
Right, and the wheels, and we can't get wheels to it because the calipers will not fit underneath those wheels, and it's kind of like I've been told, well, you're just stuck with it. Is that true?
You know, I'll tell you what, I haven't had, you know, I haven't had a lot of people expressing that sentiment about that car, and I'd have to take a look. Obviously, as a dealer, I'm typically dealing with OEM Toyota equipment, but I'd suggest you look at a larger resource like TireRack.com is a tire resource where you put your year and model in, and they can show you everything that's available for your car and the variable tire and wheel combinations that you could do, and they're taking into consideration that brake caliper and what clearances you have. I think you'll find that there are probably some choices out there. I couldn't tell you off the top of my head, but that's a resource I'd look into.
Oh, okay. Tire Rack. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. And let's move on to Matt in Middleton. And Matt, hold on. We'll get to you in just a second. I want to remind everybody that we are talking with Jim Ward today, Service Director at Smart Motors of Madison. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here, and we're taking a look at your vehicle maintenance issues with Jim Ward, Service Director at Smart Motors of Madison. Great to have him along. Thanks for listening. We'll go back to our phones and to Matt in Middleton now. Matt, thank you for waiting.
Hey, hello, Jim. I've got hopefully two easy questions for you. I have a 2009 Corolla with a manual transmission. It's got about 250,000 miles on it. And whenever the temperature is below 50 degrees and I first start driving in the morning, I'll notice some grinding or it's not necessarily hard to get into third gear, but if you hold the clutch in for 5 or 6 seconds, you don't get any grinding at all. And once the engine is warm, that goes away. I'm wondering if that could be a synchronizer issue or if it's I just need to flush the transmission fluid and maybe get a better fill. And the second question is my ABS light has come on, and I noticed on the passenger side front tire that when that started happening, the ABS system would catch at some times, and then it stopped working. So I'm wondering if that's just a sensor issue, rest of the brakes work fine, or if it's something else.
Well, let's start with the first concern about the clutch and the shifting. It certainly the one of the diagnostic things, if you're getting some transmission grind, they want to look at is what that fluid looks like. So one of the first steps they do is to drain the fluid, take a look, see what kind of metal is in there. The synchronized rings are kind of a brass, and other transmission components would be more of a silver. And that fluid may be the key here, is that that transmission fluid, like an 80-90 weight transmission fluid, works fine in warm weather. It becomes stiff enough that things don't necessarily move really nice in colder weather. So most vehicles will have a wider range, more like a synthetic 75-90 fluid to help with that. So changing that fluid may resolve that. That vehicle also, though, has a hydraulic clutch. So when it's cold, it's possible that until it warms up, that hydraulic clutch isn't giving a full throw to the disengagement lever on the transmission to be able to have the clutch disengage fully. That's something that can be evaluated if it's looked at cold. But, you know, so there's some basic things where you'd be starting out, is to make sure, first of all, that the clutch really is completely engaging, disengaging when it's cold. And then secondly, looking at that fluid. And certainly that's one of the lower cost things to try, is putting different fluid in.
Sure.
So very logical to try that. That is potentially a cause there.
What about the ABS?
And with the ABS, the light is on solid now?
Yes.
It's staying on?
I heard almost like the ABS was engaging, and it happened while I was driving down the interstate. And then the ABS system hasn't worked since, and the light came on.
So when the light's on, the ABS system isn't going to work. It's going to be disabled because the computer's saying, I don't have enough inputs to know I can operate it properly, so I'm going to disable it. And it's very possible that what you were noticing with that right front wheel was an early indicator. A wheel speed sensor on a given wheel can potentially malfunction and not be picked up by the diagnostic system. If it's telling the computer that this wheel isn't turning at the same speed as the other wheels, or it's skidding, the computer doesn't necessarily know that that's not true. And so you might find that sometimes in a turn that it seems like the ABS is starting to engage when you're potentially not even on the brake, or like where it didn't before. And it sounds like that's what you started to experience. So there's going to be a diagnostic code stored in that ABS system to tell where to start testing. And there are tests that can be done. Again, you can hook up a laptop and drive a car, even if it hasn't set a code yet. When we suspect someone reports that earlier behavior we're talking about before the light comes on, and someone suspects that, it seems like it's engaging inappropriately, we can drive the car and it shows the inputs for each wheel. So it shows the speed of each wheel, and ultimately sometimes we can actually just see on there, looking at the data as you're driving, or hopefully you're having someone else look at the data as you're driving, but you can see that one wheel is not giving the right signal. And again, the computer, initially, it doesn't necessarily know that what's really going on with that wheel, so it just takes the sensor's word for it. But the condition can deteriorate to the point where the sensor is so far out of range that then the light comes on. So I think you're on the right track there. The code needs to be pulled, the circuit needs to be tested, and you probably have a bad sensor.
Yeah, which, if the car's been 250,000 miles, that's a long time.
Yep, and that's not uncommon. Those are out there and exposed to weather, and they do go bad.
Yeah, there you go. Thanks, Matt.
Thank you.
Let's go to Tony next in Mendota, Illinois. Tony, hello.
Good morning.
Hi, Tony.
Jim, thanks for taking my call. Great show, by the way. Got a 2008 Chevy Impala. Bought it brand new. Just recently, the past couple of winters, we've noticed the inside windows is like an aquarium. Different people say run the AC for a little bit. Well, that model has a limit switch, so if it's 32 or cooler, it will not cool down. So I don't know why we're getting such moisture content recently, but in the past it's been fine.
Oh. And this goes on all year, in the winter months when it's colder, and in the summer months when it's warm?
Summer's fine. Just like I said, the past couple of winters we've experienced this, especially, when it's 5 degrees, the actuator's working fine. We do get the defrost, we do get the heat, we do get the vent.
Well, there's a range of possibilities here with what you're experiencing. The ventilation system And by the way, air conditioning systems do work in the wintertime. It ultimately, when you put your controls over to defrost, that air conditioner is on. You are not likely to get cooling because of how an air conditioner works. And as much as it really just takes moisture out of the air in the winter, it's drier. There isn't as much moisture to take out. But either moisture is not being taken out by the heater ventilation system of the car, or too much moisture is being put in the car, you can have a number of conditions. On the minor end of things, a cabin filter, a pollen filter that usually you access behind the glove box that should be changed out occasionally when it gets dirty, could potentially be plugged up enough that it just isn't taking in enough fresh air.
I did change that.
Then the ventilation typically has a mode called recirculate, which is the and you should notice a difference. If you sit in the car with the fan on high, when you switch back and forth between fresh and recirculate, you can hear a distinct difference. Usually on recirculate, it almost sounds like the fan picked up a speed.
It won't recirculate though with it in defrost.
And it should. If it's recirculate in heat. Well, and if it's in recirculate too long, or if it's stuck in recirculate, or if that door doesn't move the full throw and it's not taking enough fresh air, that's often a primary cause of the windows fogging up. That we're either stuck in recirculate, or even if the mode says it's changed, that something up in that control box, you know, either a rodent nest or some damage. I've seen models of cars where used to be these were a plastic door that'd be kind of like the plastic, like an ABS that your cell phone cover is probably made out of. In more recent years, they've started to use these. It's just a film. It doesn't look like much more than cellophane. It's more like the plastic protective cover that goes over your phone. That's kind of in a little frame that slides up and down. And those are pretty vulnerable. I've seen those get knocked out of place pretty easily. So there's some, you know, I don't know just what it is there, but I suspect we're not getting enough fresh air. And when you have it on fresh air, something in that HVAC control box is not getting that recirculate all the way off, or something's blocking so that we're really not getting enough fresh air in there to get that moisture cleared out.
Okay, one quick question on that. With the defrost, should I hear or see the AC kick in, even though I'm not going to get cool air? Should that still... that clutch still grab?
It should, and you typically can just about see that if you have a tachometer, for example, and even the load on the engine. That's more subtle than it used to be on cars, but yeah, you should still, in a subtle way, notice that.
Yep, it's not doing that. So would that show in a code, even though the engine's not coming on?
It may show in a code, but you know, one of the things that your powertrain system and can set a code that would turn a check engine light on, but typically a heating air conditioning system or like an infotainment system also has the ability to set codes, but they typically don't turn a warning light on. Someone has to go in and specifically try to draw those codes out. They don't typically turn a warning light on to tell you that something's going on there. That doesn't mean there's not a code set.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
All right. Good luck. Thank you so much for calling. Tony, appreciate your call. And Gary in Stevens Point, it's your turn. Hi, Gary.
Hi, Larry. Hi, Jim. I got a 2012 Taurus. I've got the back window shade doesn't work. The ambiance lights don't work. Those floor lights that they can get in about four different colors, and they're real low. You can have them on while you're driving.
Mm-hmm.
My driver or passenger side mirror doesn't work, and the motor in the pet driver's seat doesn't work at all. So, and I've checked the fuses. I don't have any evidence of critters chewing on stuff in the car. I'm wondering where those four items, where might they all convene?
So these problems all started up about the same time?
I don't think so. I think they were the driver's seat didn't die for probably months after I first noticed my little shade wasn't working in the back window.
Yeah, I don't think you're going to find that there's a relationship between them. Unfortunately, given models of cars have various electrical problems, and that your model is kind of known to have some a bit more in the way of electrical problems in other cars, but these systems are fairly significantly separated from each other. And it, you know, you mentioned not seeing any sign of rodents in cars, and often rodents don't like to, they like to live near us, but they don't necessarily like to be inside of us. So the evidence of rodents we often don't see until we pull the carpet up, see it underneath the carpet, or pull a console up. Sometimes they'll leave the evidence right out in plain sight, but most often not. So I'm not sure where you're looking to eliminate rodents. I'm not necessarily thinking these things are rodents, but they could be. But your power seat and your rear shade aren't going to be on the same wire harness, or have a lot of likely common junction points in a wire harness. They could, but yeah, I really, you know, if these didn't all start at the same time, they're not probably all the same cause. You know, you can, and automotive wiring diagrams are not the easiest thing to read. So if you've done that kind of work and you've done quite a bit of it, then you might get electrical wire diagram, be able to kind of ferret it out yourself. But if you haven't done much of that kind of work, it's rather difficult to look at a diagram, really follow where those connectors are. I sure don't know that car's electrical system intimately enough to be able to describe to you where to look on a wire harness. And it would take some, you know, to some looking to do it. But I have my strongest suspicion is you have a few separate different electrical problems going on.
There we go. Thank you so much for calling. Bob in Wausau emailed to say that this goes back to the retractable studs and tires. Bob says that Nokian Tires in Finland has a concept tire with retractable studs. And as you said, they will probably be very expensive, but nice. Their non-studded winter tires, he says, are amazing. So maybe that's something we can talk about when we come back from our look at the news and weather. We'll find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Network. And then we'll be back with, excuse me, Jim Ward, Service Director at Smart Motors of Madison. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network. Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Jim Ward, back with us once again. He's Service Director at Smart Motors of Madison, Toyota dealer in Madison, has over 10 years of master certification, worked with professionally with vehicles since 1978, and here to answer your vehicle maintenance questions, so I hope you'll join in. Call us at 800-642-1234, send us an email to ideas@wpr.org, or you can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page or on Twitter. Love to hear from you. Just to go back before the news, Bob had mentioned Nokian Tires. They've got a concept tire with retractable studs. He says their non-studded winter tires are amazing. And you have some experience with them, Jim.
I do. We handle Nokian tires. Nokian is a very innovative company. They're known for experimenting with various rubber compounds. And one of the keys and differences between snow tires that are not studded is that rubber compound. A few years ago, Blizzak, a few different companies, a few different tires came out that were a softer rubber compound. You know, Nokian has just been one of the leaders of that kind of technology. And they do have a patent pending on a studded snow tire, that the studs are supposed to be a type that's friendlier toward the environment, that where they're located in the tire and how they work is a little bit different than previous studs, but it's the same basic concept. Those tires coming out doesn't necessarily mean that states that ban studded tires like Wisconsin are going to then allow them. They may after a while, if it's proven that, you know, that they don't cause road damage, but obviously road damage and then getting those roads fixed again in Wisconsin, yeah, just like any other state, is an expensive undertaking that we haven't quite completely figured out how to stay on top of yet. You know, the technologies that are out there to improve winter driving, we've talked about anti-lock brakes and some of the steering and handling systems, have had more significance in terms of people staying safer in their cars in winter driving than studded snow tires would. Studded snow tires can help you get traction, to get going faster, to stay more stable, to brake better, but they also don't override driver judgment in any way whatsoever. And some of these other systems can do both of those things, can, you know, make the car handle better. So, you know, I'd welcome it if there was a tire that gets okay to use in Wisconsin. And certainly Nokian, it wouldn't surprise me if Nokian was the one to come out with it, because they certainly are known for innovation, great tires.
Let's go to Dave and Reway next. Hi, Dave. Thank you for calling.
Yeah, we've got a 2011 Nissan Rogue, and it's got 100,000 on it. We developed a vibration in the front end. Now, she did take it to a shop. They mentioned the drive shaft going to the rear wheels, but it just feels like it's in the front end, and Googling it up, it seems like people have reported it to Nissan, and they won't recognize it.
So how do you sense this? How do you sense this vibration? When does it happen?
Oh, you know, I haven't been in a lot, but it seemed like it was under load and certain speeds, and we did have new tires put on it.
Do you notice it through the steering wheel?
Yeah, the whole front end, the whole you can kind of feel it even in the passenger seat.
And you mentioned you got new tires recently, but did you have it prior to the new tires?
Not really.
Yeah.
But it just seems like a vibration that it's so, sure. You know, so quick. It just doesn't seem like it'd be a tire.
Well, I'll tell you, the most characteristic thing for a vibration that is kind of like the hand massage you're driving down the road, a certain and it's tires that are out of balance will most likely be in a certain speed range, not at all speeds, and it'll be that fine shimmy that feels like a you know, some kind of massage vibrator or something. And a tire that's out of balance is the most by far common cause of that. A wheel bearing, a brake concern, a brake rotor that's out of round enough, a dry shaft problem can all contribute to something like that. But if you feel it in the steering wheel and it seemed to be something you noticed, I would have the place at the shop that installed those tires recheck them. Tire balance is not something you can see with the naked eye. It's something that you're doing with a machine. It tells you where to put the weight. It's a computer design, and they get out of calibration. We have to have the company we get our tire machines from come in and take a look at that regularly. And it is, you know, and it's possible too that there's some human error involved. It may tell you to put on so much weight right here. Did he reach over and grab the right weight? But you know, the timing of this and the way you're describing this sounds like a tire balance problem to me. And it, you know, I think it's certainly going to be the easiest thing to detect and eliminate.
Yeah, absolutely. Good luck, Dave. Thank you for calling. Ann in Milwaukee, your turn now. Hi, Ann.
Hi, good afternoon. Thank you so much for doing this show.
Sure.
Three issues came up from my last dealer visit, and I have a 2003 Toyota Camry LE four-cylinder with about only 155,000 miles on it. The first one is they recommended doing a fuel injection cleaning, and I was told that that's preventative maintenance needed every 55 to 60,000 miles. I've noticed no difference in my driving. So I guess my first question is, does my car periodically need this service, or is that the dealer just trying to oversell? The second thing is the check engine light was on, and it came back that the exhaust manifold needs replacement with an updated part, and they need to reflash something called the ECU, and that was per a technical service bulletin. So my question on that is it preferred to use original equipment from Toyota, or is aftermarket equipment okay on that replace? And the third thing is they said a power steering hose, fluid line hose is leaking, and this is the return line off the reservoir. And I did have that taken to an independent shop, and they just said that the hose is sweating and not leaking, and that maybe a spring clamp is slightly loose because the fluid levels have, you know, are still between the min and max. And I'm just wondering if that sounds right.
Mm-hmm. Well, the fuel injection cleaning is something called preventative maintenance. It would fall into that category. However, it's not Toyota's preventative maintenance. Toyota has a maintenance guide and tells you what you should do on that car, and fuel injection cleaning is not part of that. Toyota, on the other hand, does make fuel injection cleaning kits, and typically, you know, it's something that if you're not having any symptoms, generally, it's not something that we go pursuing and saying you need this on a regular mileage basis just because. Now, fuel injectors do fail. They can get, you know, plugged up with deposits that are in fuel. And it is possible that if you do regular fuel injection services, that you might potentially, you know, eliminate or bypass having to replace one of those injectors somewhere down the road, which, you know, would not necessarily be a breakdown issue, but might cause your car to start to misfire. But, you know, fuel injectors, I don't tend to see failing until the cars are 175, 200,000 miles often, and not that they can't fail earlier than that. And again, you know, if you do a few of these fuel injection services, you might avoid that happening, but you're probably going to spend just as much, if not more, doing those services. I can't fault a given shop. If in a given shop, you know, we go through a fuel injector failures, and sometimes you'll get a streak where you know, you swear, man, is there something they're putting in the fuel? Why am I seeing these? And someone may say, you know, maybe we should start doing these fuel injector cleanings more often. And they're not necessarily coming from a bad place and thinking that, but you know, over the long run, I don't tend to see that. And on Toyotas, I tend to see really good luck staying with the manufacturer's recommendations if you're not having other problems. One of the things I guess I would look at is that there are also additives that you can put in your fuel that are, you know, not as expensive as the dealer doing an injector service. So these are basically solvents, and you might be a little careful what you use. Are some solvents that are too strong, but you could put a solvent in the fuel in the tank that does help clean out the same kind of deposits. The dealer doing that injection service is going to be a little bit more aggressive type of service and probably remove them quicker than several tanks of gas of using a fuel system cleaner. But again, if you're not having any symptoms and any problems, I don't tend to recommend those things. I wouldn't condemn a shop that does, again, based on their experience that, you know, they may see a reason for doing that. With the manifold and the bulletin, the update, the original, you know, and there's a bulletin because something about the original design and the relationship between how, and it isn't necessarily the manifold part of that component. There's a catalyst in that manifold, and it's really that catalyst that they're replacing. But that's been redesigned. It's a countermeasure design, and then the software has been changed to address it. Theoretically, there's nothing wrong with using an aftermarket part. I guess I would just want to, you know, in the aftermarket, that they're probably not going to have the software change. I don't know that anybody in the aftermarket necessarily would have the countermeasure. I'm not saying they don't, and there's certainly nothing wrong with using like-for-like aftermarket parts. There's plenty of them out there. When we were talking about headlights fogging earlier, the factory ones are very expensive, and the aftermarket sometimes are a quarter of the price. So I'm not against aftermarket parts at all. But yeah, you have to check into, you know, check with a reputable shop that does that kind of exhaust work in the aftermarket, and see if they're familiar with that bulletin, that problem. They think that their design is a countermeasure that would address that. That power steering, if your fluid levels up, you're not getting drifts on the ground, the shop that's pointing that out is being really proactive. In our business, we should be consultative, and it's difficult to, you know, sometimes people will just give you a list. Here's 10 things we saw in your car, you know, and ultimately they really should be put in kind of an order of priority. I mean, if you brought your car in for a specific concern, that's the first thing I want to talk to you about. You brought it in for this. Let's talk about that. This is what we found or what we saw. And then secondly is whatever's immediate. It's a rainy day. Your wipers are torn. They're terrible. I got to drive on the same roads as you. Let's talk about your wipers. And lastly, maintenance. Things that are just scheduled maintenance would be the last thing we'd want to talk about. And they really should be discussed in that order of priority. That you know, this is, and even, you know, what you brought it in for might not be that important. Maybe one of those other items is far more important, which you brought it in for. But nonetheless, you know, if a shop that doesn't talk to you in those terms isn't necessarily a bad shop, they just not have realized yet that really you're going to be a much more trusting customer if things are put to you in an order of priority. You know, that they probably love nothing more than to build that trust, but that doesn't necessarily mean they figured it out in their communication. They give you a list of 10 things and describe them all as being equally needed, and that's not really going to be the reality. Something's going to be more important than others. Some things are elective and can be put off. You know, I don't doubt that they saw something wet on that power steering return line, but the fluid's not down. You know, it's something that they could suggest you monitor. It doesn't sound like anything that needs any current action right now, is a keep an eye on it kind of thing. And so, you know, ideally as consumers, that's what we all want, is someone to give us descriptions of things, whether it's our health or our car or our house or our lawn or our garden. You know, give me the information, you know, with levels of priority and descriptions that I can use to make decisions on when I think I need to do these things.
Yeah.
Mitch. Right. Thank you for that. And let me just ask you one more question on the exhaust manifold. So you mentioned that if I would go with an aftermarket unit, that it might not have a software change. So am I really better off going back and getting OEM for a new catalytic converter?
If there's no aftermarket answer out there for it, then that's the only answer. You don't want to just replace the part and have the same problem if it's not a countermeasure and a change.
Yep. There you go.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Ann. And on to Rob in Milwaukee next, I believe. Hi, Rob.
Hi. I have a 2007 Honda Accord V6, 60,000 miles with the original timing belt. Was told that the timing belt should be replaced after 9 years. Also told if the timing belt breaks, it will destroy the engine. The cost is $1,100 to replace. Honda drives okay. What happened to the $400 or $500 timing belt replacement? What do you do?
Well, the timing belt is an all or nothing thing in terms of performance. It's a geared belt and it's either working properly or not. So you're not going to notice a performance difference at all until the belt jumps. And at that point, there is no performance. It stops running. Most engines that have a timing belt are what we call non-interference engines. An interference engine is one that, if the timing belt is not controlling how the upper and lower half of the engine rotate, and they're just let to freewheel, there's going to be collisions of components that result in destruction of the engine. Manufacturers, Toyota and Honda, neither one have been the best about being forthright in disclosing exactly which, because there are some engines out there that have timing belts that are interference engines. So your Honda, again, I would take a careful look. Most timing belt intervals are longer than 60,000 miles. I can't say I have Honda's interval memorized, but you will have with your car. You can certainly look it up online, the maintenance schedule that Honda recommends for that. So that belt should be replaced at that interval. And there are all of the service intervals are by time or mileage. So, you know, I'm remembering 90,000 miles is what I thought that was, but I would look at that guide to see what it says the interval is. But again, there's a presumption you drive about, you know, different manufacturers use different figures, 12 to 15,000 miles a year. So they'll say, well, you know, it should take, you know, 6 years to get to that 90,000 mile point. But if at 6 years you only have 60,000 miles, well, you've hit the 6 years or 90,000 miles. This is still the time you should replace the timing belt. And I'm not necessarily saying that's wrong, because manufacturers all do have the timer mileage. So, but I look at the manufacturer's recommendation, and that's what you want to go with.
All right.
But is this something that I can destroy the engine if it doesn't get replaced?
If it's an interference engine, that is true. And honestly, I don't believe it is, but that's information that is, it just isn't listed as a spec typically for those engines. There's a couple of Toyota engines that I have even talked to engineers on who can't quite tell me, and we religiously encourage and replace those belts at their intervals because we don't want to find out the hard way. It just isn't, you know, I don't have the answer to that question, and you can research it. I guarantee you if you Google it, you'll find on one page at least two conflicting things telling you it's interference or it's not. If it is an interference engine, there's going to be damage.
Yeah, there you go. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Smita emailed to say she's looking for a new minivan which can climb up the snowy hill leading to her house. Would changing a regular minivan's tires to snow tires work as well, or should she be going with a four-wheel drive minivan?
Well, generally all-wheel drive or four-wheel drive is going to give you better traction and handling on hills when the vehicle's traction is not just compromised by the hill, but by the weight shift of the vehicle. When you're going up a hill, the weight shifted to the back, so front-wheel drive loses a little bit of the front traction. Snow tires can make a huge difference, though. A front-wheel drive minivan that's got snow tires is going to do better than a four-wheel drive minivan that's got bald tires. I don't know how steep this driveway is or how snowy it is. But
sounds like it must be steep.
there are increased costs involved with owning and driving all-wheel drive vehicles. And some manufacturers, particularly in the segment of vans, when you make it all-wheel drive, you lose some utility space. And sometimes that's at the expense of having a spare tire, meaning that the tires on those vehicles are often run flat tires. Not all manufacturers. Toyota does use that system, though. They don't have a snow tire on those vehicles. Those run flat tires are far more expensive to replace. So you might get some increased performance in snow. But again, I for my own sake, I would be inclined to try the snow tires. You know, mm-hmm. It's not a huge expense to put snow tires on it and see what kind of performance you get, as opposed to turning around buying a completely different vehicle that's all-wheel drive that is most certainly going to guarantee to have more maintenance cost.
I do like that Highlander, though.
They do well.
They do very well. Oh, boy. Michael in Milwaukee, thank you for calling. Hello.
Hi there. I have a Mercury Milan all-wheel drive six-cylinder Premier, and I had an oil change at a shop I usually don't go to, and the mechanic told me that I have near the propeller blade, I think differential fluid spraying out. He said something about the nut near the motor, and I just wondered if that makes any sense to you, how dangerous that might be.
Well, I don't know that it's dangerous. There's some terms that we use in this business that are really confusing. And one of them is we call a drive shaft a propeller shaft. A lot of manufacturers call that. You know, where is the propeller? There is no propeller. But that the shaft that goes back and runs a propeller on a boat is called the propeller shaft, so they continue to call that on vehicles. So it's simply a drive shaft that they're talking about. And typically, where a drive shaft goes into a differential, there is a seal, and that seal is typically called a pinion seal, and that seal may be seeping some fluid. So some of the questions that come up is, what is the level of fluid remaining in that differential? It's got a side plug where a guy puts his finger in there, and you kind of use that as a dipstick and feel down, and there's a level at which the fluid should be. That gear lube is a much heavier lube than engine oil, so it doesn't tend to run out at the rate engine oil does, just a very little bit of it seeping out. Of course, it's seeping out onto a drive shaft that's spinning, and it gets slung around, and it can look like a lot more than there is. So a pinion seal is not necessarily my differential is going to bleed to death. Oh, my God, I have to do something right now issue. It may be a slow leak. The fluid level in the differential might be okay. That should be checked. If it's not, or if at some point you decide I've got enough money, I'm going to fix that. If it's decided it's just seeping out, but I'm a little ahead now, I'm going to fix it. One of the things to keep in mind when it's repaired is that there's a vent on that differential, and those vents can get plugged, and they can be the reason that a leak occurred in the first place, because if the vent is plugged, pressure builds up, pushes the seal out a little bit, and fluid starts to go out, because then it's also venting out where that seal was. So, you know, have the fluid level checked. If it's okay, this isn't an urgent thing right now. If that's the case, keep an eye on it so that you know if it does change and the leak gets worse and you need to take action. And if at some point you decide to have it fixed, make sure to also have them check the vent to make sure you don't put a new seal in to find out a couple months later that one's leaking now too because we weren't venting properly.
Robert emailed to say his Toyota Camry, the rear end feels like it's shifting, sliding, or jumping slightly when driving over bumps about 40 miles an hour. Any thoughts on that?
Well, you know, you're feeling something different, and there's clearly something unstable, and it does need to be checked out. A shifting rear end, the feeling that the rear end shifting can occur from a number of things, you know, depending on how long this has been going on. Anything from the knuckle and hub that your wheel bearing is in, I've seen those things be able to develop play where they could shift a little bit, and then all of a sudden the car suddenly is pulling really hard in one direction. So, you know, that basically it needs to be pursued. And if this has come on suddenly, I mean, even a tire that got rotated or replaced and isn't on tight could be shifting and could be in danger of that tire coming off. So this isn't the kind of thing I'd put off. I'd get that checked out, get it checked out right away, take somebody for a ride, show them what you're experiencing. You know, I can think of an instance in my own experience where we had someone come in a couple different times and saying, and there was a bit of a language barrier in that situation, and saying, I have this pull, and somebody went out for a ride and we didn't feel it. Second time, we didn't feel it. And I went out with the third time, and going down the belt line, everything felt fine. And then suddenly, I felt like I was hit by a 200-mile-an-hour wind trying to push me in the other lane. And it was a knuckle that was shifting on the hub. And it you know, that's not a common thing, but it's a dangerous thing. And so I'm going to encourage you to take this to a shop, or you can take somebody for a ride and have them check it out and make sure we don't have something dangerous like that going on.
Well, I tell you what, we're out of time, Jim, but boy, you did a wonderful job, and I you'll be back and be with us again, I presume, or hope.
Yep, I think so. I think we're talking about in a couple months again. It's always fun. It's always interesting and amazing to hear what people are experiencing and what they think it is and what we can best guess that it might be. So it's been a blast.
Jim Ward, Service Director at Smart Motors. Thank you for listening. Stay with us.